Okay, so Parsha. So this is there's an interesting article that was written last year by Rabbi Eli Fisher on which I found fascinating on Rav Mendel of Rimonov's take on the reading of the Parsha of the month. It's obviously this week, B'Shalach has so many things going on. It's hard sometimes to focus. We try to do a little bit of each, right? Leaving Mitzrayim, Kriyat Yamsuf, but the Mun is there as well. So this is based on his article. So the Mun, as we know, is not only is it really important insofar as it sustains the Jews in the Midbar, all the way, right, until they get to Eretz Yisrael. But the Psukim make it very clear that the message of the man is eternal. And how do the Psukim do that? Right, what do the Psukim say? You're chayev to put, yeah, you put the tzinsen aman in the aron, right? Right, we keep right so that you will remember it, right? It's quite clear that this is something you're supposed to remember. And the Gemara goes farther, and the Gemara in Brachot goes as far as saying that the bracha of Hazan et Hakol, the first bracha of benching, is supposed to remind you of the mud, right? So this is the type of thing that really is supposed to remind you, right, of important lessons forever. What you have starting in the time of the Gaonim is the minhag to say the parsha of the man on a regular basis, maybe on a daily basis. And this is, in fact, quoted already in the Tur, right? It's not already. It's quoted in the Tur, right? And in Shulchan Aruch, that there's a value, that it's not a chiyuv, but there's a value to reciting Parshat Haman every day. So why? So the Beis Yosef says that one reason is because it reminds you that everything we get, all of our sustenance comes from God, right? That's the message of the Mun, and therefore we don't have the Mun to look at. So saying the Psukim of the Mun help us remind us of the message of the Mun. The Prisha adds to this that there is a segula that he heard from his Rebbe, that anyone who says the Parsha of the Mun every day will be assured that he doesn't have too little food, right? He'll be assured that he will not have too little food. Now, it's possible, obviously, that these are related, right? These are not exclusive, and that, right, the reason that you're promised that you'll have sustenance isn't just magical, but is if you say the Parsha of the Mun and internalize the fact that everything you get in life is from God, and God is the one who can and does provide you with your sustenance, then in the merit of that, God will continue to provide you with your sustenance, right? So it might not just be like, you know, magic. It might be the no, right? The segula is if you actually internalize the message of the Mun, then you will get the blessing of the Mun. Now, despite these early sources that, and again, classic sources that say that there is this minhag of saying Parshat Haman every day, there's a later skula that develops that there's particular value to saying it on, to do the Shtayim Mikra of the Parsha of the Mon, specifically on the Tuesday of Parshat Bishalach. You heard of this before? I'd never heard of this before I read this article. Oh, there you go, right? So this is a Hasidish minhag, right? It's quoted in the Nitei Gavriel, who attributes it to Avram Shalom Halberstam of Strupkov, who in turn references it, and this is how we get, to the Rimonover, right? To Menachem Mendel of Rimonov. Your father likes the Rimonover, if I remember, right? Of Hasidim, I've heard him quote the Rimonover. Yeah, somehow I have a copy of the Rimonover's Torah. Someone was giving away Svarim, and in the pile of Svarim was it. So I do have it on my shelf somewhere. So what Eli Fisher points out in his article is that it's not just that there's this unique segula to the Rimonover that you should say the Shtayim Mikra of the Parsha of the Mon on Tuesday of Parsha B'Shalach. But the Rimanover apparently was obsessed with the ideas of the Mon. And apparently, if you look in his drashot, Menachem Tzion, now I have to look at it, now that I have it on my shelf. But in the Hakdama, Rav Yecheskel Panet says that the Rimanover spoke about the Mon as the topic of his drasha every Shabbat, not just B'Shalach, but every Shabbat for 22 years, right? Okay, so his drashot were devoted to the message of the Mon every Shabbos for 22 years. And therefore, it wasn't just that he had this thing with the Mon once a year. He thought that the ideology of the Mon was central to Jewish life. So what was it, right? What is it about the Mon? And here you find really fascinating ideas. The Rimanover, it's not just that he liked this one idea, but he developed a whole theology around the Mon, which is really, really fascinating. So first of all, he says, he's Mechadesh in several places, that he thinks that the Mon was not eaten, but it was inhaled. It didn't go down the esophagus, but it was inhaled through the trachea. And the reason he thinks is because there was nothing superfluous about the Mon. It was exactly what the body needed to keep the body intact and tethered to the soul and nothing more. And therefore it produced no waste. It was like air, right? We breathe it in and that was, and therefore he says it purified and refined the body and the mind. And this he repeats many times. Then he says, okay, so what does this teach us? So apparently this, I'm randomly quoting from this article directly, right? The corollary of this theme comports strongly with his broader attitude towards consumerism. Consumerism beyond the essential can lead down a dangerous path. And apparently from his letters, we discover that he was particularly concerned about people changing the way they dress, for example. He even got upset about people changing the direction of the buttoning. And he warned people, don't take on European styles. So what was he getting at, right? What was it with the Mon? Why does he take this as this broad opposition to consumerism? Right, what exactly is he, right? Where is this obsession with this theology and this, I don't know, why is this so important to him? So it could be that you could have just said, listen, he's a reactionary, right? He was threatened by new things. But what Ray Fisher notes is that, there's more to it. It is true. That he might have been reacting, but he said that among Hasidish Rebbes, he isn't the most reactionary, right? So, for example, when Napoleon Bonaparte was winning and was bringing rights that certain people were really scared of because they thought it would uproot Jewish tradition, like the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, he wasn't, right? He was actually pro. He had a somewhat pro Napoleon sense, right? He wasn't afraid of change per se. So what he argues is that if you want to understand what he is thinking, you got to know a little bit about his biography. So, he's from Germany. Originally. And then he moves towards the east, right? He moves to Galicia, which is the opposite of what most people did. Right, most people were, if they lived in the shtetl and they wanted to modernize, they moved to Germany. But the Rimanover, you see the opposite, right? That he's born there and he doesn't like it. He actively leaves that culture and goes to the backwaters of Galicia, right? Back to the shtetl, right? So you see that it's not just in his talks, right? He actually has a, right? It's not just that he opposes culture in his drashot, but he lives that, right? He really sees something wrong there. So what does he say? So here's a few quotes. He says, When we were in the iron furnace, absorbed and immersed in the abominations of Egypt, we were ignorant of God to the extent that the ministering angel said, these are idolaters and those are idolaters. But God's truth is eternal. He kept his covenant and oath to our forefathers that he would make us a holy nation and a treasured people. Therefore, he brought us into the wilderness, gave us bread from heaven, which was entirely spiritual and intellectual. It had no waste and was thus absorbed entirely into the body. Indeed, even today, in this cruel and bitter exile, we long and yearn for the man. Oh, that we might be fed from it so that we may have the eyes to remove occlusion from our hearts and cast away the fog of folly from before us. Right. So in this discourse, I'm still quoting from the article, Egypt, the most advanced culture of the day, is parallel to the present exile, which occludes our heart and enshrouds us in a fog of folly. In this scheme, the man is a detox diet, a simple austere regimen that cleanses us from the ill effects of the idolatrous culture that we absorbed. Another discourse links the manna with the turn away from general culture, opposition in changing modes of dress, and the general spirit of competition and jealousy that animates the desire to consume more. Quote, it is known that anyone who wants to become closer to God must first fix his character and make good, upright character part of his habit and nature. The root of all good character traits is to love kindness and to be benevolent to all, and to increase peace with every person. This will cause the removal of jealousy toward another person from his heart. Scripture teaches us that when it says, your clothes did not wear out from on you, this implies that all 40 years they obtained the same styles and modes, even though each of them owned 90 fully loaded donkeys. Nevertheless, they sufficed with one set of clothes, right? So here he says, it's not just the man, right? The psukim say, your clothes never worn out, right? Wore out in the midbar. From this, the Rebbe never says, what that means is they only wore the same clothes. If they had a million pairs of clothes, what's the chiddush? It didn't wear out. They, even though they were wealthy, because they took all that from Egypt, they chose to wear the same clothes and allow God to magically make it that it didn't wear out. But that's all they needed, was the same pair of clothes. They didn't have different styles. All they needed was the same pair of clothes. Right? They didn't seek out new modes of dress as people are accustomed to doing nowadays. As each day anew, they changed their style of dress. No 2 days are the same. In Egypt, there were worthless Israelites, as there are in the present exile, when many go wrong by wearing new Gentile clothing each day. They did not leave Egypt. However, those who merited to leave Egypt held fast to the traits of their forefathers and did not change their conduct. Thus, even while they were in the wilderness, they did not change their tastes. And to support and reinforce this, they were given the manna to ingrain within them the trait of frugality and not seeking luxuries. If the manna had any appearance or aroma, it would have caused a bit of envy, for one would see that his friend's manna appeared different from his own. This is not the case when it comes to taste, which is sensed only by the palate of the person eating. Right, so then the Rebbe never makes another move, and he says, Chazal tell us that the man tasted like whatever you like. Right, but he said, but why wasn't it magic? Why didn't it change into whatever you like? Look different, smell different, right? Why is it only taste? So he comes up with this idea that the reason is because God wanted them to taste whatever they want, but he wanted no jealousy. Right, and it smells, someone else can smell it. Looks, someone else can see it and then say, oh, that looks great, I want what you have. But if it all looks the same, it's the same, you know, white nothingness, right? But it tastes as you like, so then it, even if you're going to enjoy it, it undermines the ability of envy, right? Because everyone's looks the same. You have no idea what people are actually experiencing, and therefore you're not going to be jealous of what other people have. And therefore they can resist these material temptations which lead to assimilation, idolatry, bondage, and the like. So now with all of this, you can come back and say, why was it the Rebbe never talked about man so much? And why does he have this gula? Well, your father sent it out, what, for the shul? Okay, nice. Right, so why is it, right? Why is he identified with it? And the reason is because what he saw in the man was basically for him the answer to Galicia, right? Was that, right, what he saw were people in Galicia who were poor, and many of them felt the pull to go to Germany, right? But what he saw in Germany was, right, materialism, jealousy, envy, and him having come from Germany, right, he sees in the man the answer, a theology for the poor people of Galicia, telling them, listen, what took us out of Egypt was that we had the man, which for him, we inhaled it because it wasn't even food. It was just what we needed. And to the extent that we tasted it, right, We only tasted it. God wanted us to enjoy what we had, but he didn't want us to have envy, and therefore had no smell, and it didn't look different, right? God would allow us to enjoy, but he would never allow us to envy. And therefore, what it, for him, the man was the answer to the people who stayed in the shtetl and telling them you don't need to desire, right? The fundamental sin that the man was trying to push us away from was envy, was always thinking that there's more in materialism. And for him, this is the experience of the midbar, not just the man, also the clothes, right? The fact that the miracle isn't that God gave us a new pair of clothes every day, right? But that God made sure our clothes didn't wear out, is that you need what you need and what you have, but you don't need the newest clothes, you don't need the newest food, you don't need what the other person needs. And for him, the man was God's response to that consumerism, that jealousy, right? That constantly needing to be richer, right? And take it, right? And follow the newest trend. And for him, right, that's what the man was all about. Right, and therefore, what Rav Fisher adds, he says, maybe the segula, as it were, of the man for the Rimanover is not just to make us wealthy, but to make us wealthy in the real sense, right? Which is to teach us to be content with what we have, right? And maybe that's what it is, right? Because when you talk about wealth, it could be that you get more, or it could be that you no longer need more, right? And that maybe, right, the Rimanover's ideology leads you to believe that the point of the man and saying the man is not just so that you get more, but that you learn the lessons of the man, which for the Rimanover is to always be content with what you have. Realize that you don't need what everyone else has. You don't need the newest thing. What you need is, right, sufficient, and is what's sufficient for you. And that was the ideology of the man. So that is a little bit on the Rimanover's commitment to really pushing the ideas of the man with his additions, which, again, whether it's pshat or drash, I think it's a beautiful drash at the very least, and it's a way of this is like in the best tradition of drash, of taking right something and building it in such a way that it really speaks to the modern time, which, as much as he's talking in his time, I think the ideas of suffice it, right, recognizing that we have is from God, recognizing that true wealth comes from being happy with what we have, with not needing what everyone else has, but enjoying what we do have, that I think is, if anything, has gotten worse since the Rimanover, and therefore the man and this drush of the Rimanover on the man really does add a lot to our, remind us of what's important in life in our even more consumer-oriented society. Okay, so those are some ideas.